Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's program has been brought to you by TechServe, New York's original and still the best Apple computer, iPod, and iPhone store and repair shop. For more information, visit TechServe.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Cooking issues!
Welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live in the back of Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn, joined as usual with Nastasha the Hammer Lopez. How are you doing, Nastasha?
Good.
And we got Joe in the engineering room. Still no Jack. Did he die?
Or is he just still in Puerto Rico?
Still in Puerto Rico, but it's like, was he planning on being there this long, or is he dead, or has he just decided to move there?
I think he's back from Puerto Rico.
Just hates us.
You're going to have to talk with him about that.
So actually, you know, today... Nastasha, is like this is my perfect kind of weather. It's freaking awesome. This is New York, late fall at its best, uniformly overcast. There's not one ray of sun touching my disgusting white body, burning me to death. Like my nemesis, my evil nemesis, the sun. And
today is the most fertile day of the year, actually.
What does that mean, fertile?
Most people have sex and get pregnant today.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Well, unrelated to me being so happy about the...
You said it was a great day. Right?
It is a great day. Yeah. So apparently it's a great day for a lot of people. Yeah. A lot of people getting busy, getting lucky today. But also, Nastasha, and I think maybe this is part of it, although not historically, who knows, is it's exactly the right temperature. If it was like 3 degrees colder, you could see your breath outside. And if it was 3 degrees warmer, the crazies would come out.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, there are no crazies on the street. And not to mention, for those of you that are going to visit Roberta's Pizzeria and hate hipsters as much as Nastasha does, there's a secret back way to Roberta's. You don't come from the Williamsburg direction or from the L train direction, which is like hipster train. You come from the J train direction down from Flushing Avenue, and you pass not one hipster entire walk. Either that or hipsters are like crazy people, and they just don't come out when it gets a little bit nippy. Is it because it doesn't take that much energy to be crazy, and usually crazies are just outside being crazy, and so they get cold? Because like when we're outside, we're moving around. You'd have to shoot me to get me to just stand outside and do nothing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know. Interesting phenomenon, the crazies. The crazies and the temperature. Anyway, beautiful fall day. Call in your questions live to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. We're going to answer Stan Bellow's question from a million years ago that we keep on forgetting to answer. And here we go. Enjoy the show on podcast only as I'm in France. A great way to gain knowledge on cooking, good fun to listen to, and funky in a good way, choice of music. Although now, you know, we have the user submitted music, and so we have two different styles, which I thoroughly enjoy. You like that stuff, right, Stas?
Mm-hmm.
It's good business. Okay, I would appreciate your answering a question. I'd like to create a small appetizer, maybe 2 bites. The idea is to take 2 medium prawns and flash cook them so they stay juicy and remove the shell and pair them with 2 contrasting textures. I'd like to pair 1 prawn with an ultra-light, very brittle meringue, in quotes, and the other one with a very chewy gummy bear, also in quotes. For the meringue, 1 egg white whipped to which we add lemon juice or another flavorful water, water-based flavor, I'm assuming, until very light, then stabilize with sugar or another hydrocolloid. Of course, the hydrocolloid can be pre-mixed in the flavored water first, then put it in the oven to dry up. I could not find any indications on stabilizing egg whites in your hydrocolloid primer. Any suggestions for that? Sugar could work, but not sure of the resulting taste with prawns or a savory dish. Okay, so let's go into that before we go into the gummy bear. So, yeah, sugar makes the egg white denser and gives it structure for when it's drying up. But, as you say, sugar is sweet, so you don't want to add a lot of sugar. You could use a different, especially if you were going to do a cooked meringue where you cook the sugar beforehand and beat it in, cook so that it already stays cooked and then you dry it out. You could use a less sweet sugar like isomalt. But it will still be somewhat sweet. There are other, completely non-sweet things that have the properties of sugar you could add. Or you could do what I would do, which is go in an entirely different direction and use methylcellulose. If you use methylcellulose F50, right, you can take whatever flavor base you want. If it doesn't have any sort of substance to it, you're going to need to add some bulking agent, like a maltodextrin or something that is going to provide some structure to it. So, if there's no protein in it, if there's no pectin, if there's no anything, you're going to need some structure. Then you add methylcell F50, anywhere between about 0.75 and up to, but don't go over, 1% of methylcell F like Frank, 50. And you add it in a blender while it's mixing high speed so it doesn't clump up. And then if you want, if it doesn't work, if you're worried about it not working, you can let it sit and hydrate for a while. It might not work in a milk base. You might not want to do it in milk base. But then you just whip it in a KitchenAid with a balloon whisk. It'll whip up like egg whites. Then you can pipe it into any shape you want. And then you can dehydrate it in a dehydrator or in a low oven. And they're crisp. They're great. You can make anything with any flavor. You could go dead savory. You could go sweet. And it doesn't have any of the residual protein stuff that's left. So it's very, very light and airy. And the less methylcellulose you use, the larger the bubbles will be and the more airy it will be. But I tend to like in the area of about 0.9% or 9 grams per liter of your product. Now, listen. Here's the important thing. Methylcellulose has trouble in that if you leave a methylcellulose meringue out for a long time, it's going to absorb moisture and lose its crunch. So you're going to want to keep it either if you're going to use a dehydrator, and I apologize, this is the one thing I know in Fahrenheit because my dehydrator only works in Fahrenheit. You want to dehydrate at around 135 degrees Fahrenheit, but you're going to want to store it at like 112, 110, 120, much lower than 135, because if you store it at that high temperature, if you cook it for a long time, I'm talking like a day or two, to hold it, it's going to start tasting cooked. Now, you need to keep it in a dehydrator when you're getting ready for service because it's going to absorb moisture. Or you can package it along with a desiccant, which is a silica gel that a lot of pastry people get. And you just package it in a container with the desiccant. The desiccant will remove all the moisture and keep it crunchy. But that's what I would do if I wanted a meringue that was totally stable because it doesn't require very much thinking or very much tweaking. And it works all the time, and I like it. Okay, now, for the gummy bear, I wanted to grind some sage up fine along with tarragon or other herb, add ground star anise or something like that, and just a bit of water with high acyl gel in and or iota carrageenan. Now remember, well, I'll finish. Once gelled, the gum would be cut in a few 1x1x1 centimeter cubes to be eaten whole with the prawn. Any advice on how to use the herb so that the gummy bear really packs a punch of flavor? Which hydrocolloid should I use? Any problems with flavor release, temperature, or acidity to think about? Okay, so here's the deal. There's two kinds of gelan, for those of you who don't, and gelan is one of these gelling agents, newer age gelling agents. It's natural, but it's, derived, from microbial fermentation. There's high acyl gelan and low acyl gelan. Low acyl gelan is brittle, like agar, it's brittle. There you have it. High acyl gelan is very elastic. I do not enjoy straight up high acyl gelan preparations because they're extremely rubbery. They don't really imitate gummy bears. And the other one you mentioned, iota carrageenan, also. So iota carrageenan, kappa carrageenan, two most common carrageenans people use. Kappa, brittle, like agar. In fact, it's very closely related to agar. And iota, which is elastic and stretchy. Also, iota, typically, when you're using it in low concentrations for things like puddings because it allows you to shear it and then have it reset up into a gel. That's kind of its unique property, along with reacting very nicely with milk. But neither of those two things alone are going to impart a real gummy bear texture. Why not just use gelatin? Gelatin is amazing, has great flavor release, and you know there's a lot of recipes out there for you know how to do high gelatin preparations for real gummy bear. Because remember, the hallmark of a gummy you like gummy bears, right, Sus?
Uh-huh.
A real hallmark. They should be hard, right? They're hard. What do you mean? They're physically you have to bite into them. Yeah. They don't just break apart like a marshmallow. You right. don't like marshmallows. Is it you that doesn't like marshmallows, or just doesn't care about them?
Handmade marshmallows, I don't like.
You like jet puffed?
Yeah.
Store bought marshmallows. Yes. What is it you don't like about the handmade marshmallows again? I forget. Mm-hmm. Is it the idea, or is there something
the
about the texture?
The sound of the scissors cutting it.
The sound of the scissors cutting it. What if it was cut in a different room? Maybe. You think about the scissors, and then you're like, yes. I can't enjoy this because I know that at some point it was cut with a scissor. Wow. All right. All right. I'm just going to let that one stay. So the properties of a gummy bear that you're trying to get with a gummy are that they are cohesive, elastic, and hard. Okay, and if you look on there's a patent out right now of someone using a mixture of gelan and carrageenan, but not I believe they're using low-ace, or the brittle one. So the gelan's there to provide the hardness, and you can use gelan at a fairly low proportions. This is only if you want to do a vegetarian gummy. Otherwise, I would just use gelatin. You know, gelan's going to provide the hardness, and the iota is going to provide. Or they don't use iota; they use a mixture of iota and I believe new, which is a you know, there's a billion different not a billion like. Eight different carrageenans, but the you know new is one of the ones that we don't really use much. But they in the patent literature, and you can look at it. It is the inventors are Andrew J. Grazella and Neil Argo Morrison on a gelatin-free gummy confection comprising the combination of gelan gum and new carrageenan and/or new iota carrageenan blend. So the gelan is there for the hardness, and the iota is there for the elasticity and the cohesiveness. And the recipe is actually there in the patent, so you can go look at it, which is a good thing to do. But I recommend just using gelatin unless you don't want a gummy bear. Now, you're in France, a lot of people like, you know, the pectin texture, in which case just go high pectin. Nothing like, in terms of very good flavor release and high concentrations, gelatin and pectin are the way to go. Gelan is good, but in high concentrations can get kind of weird. I've never done a super high concentration of like a high acyl, low acyl mix to try and imitate gelatin. But anyone out there with some advice, we'll take it. Right?
Mm-hmm.
We'll take it. Okay. So I apologize for not answering that question for so long. Right?
Right.
Actually, Stan had a really interesting idea that we've never done about rotovaps. Stan was saying, different flavors, right, have different kind of solubilities in different mediums, like alcohol or oil or blah, 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 right? So typically when we rotovap something, we rotovap the entire product to try and get as much flavor out of it as humanly possible, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what he's saying, why not – have you ever tried, for instance, doing an oil extraction of something or an alcohol extraction versus a water extraction and then rotovap those extractions without the product in it to try and separate different aspects of the flavor? Nope. Good idea, though. You could try it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mike writes in about lemongrass. Happy holidays to everyone at Cooking Issues. Oh, that's right. Is next week our last one before the holidays?
Yeah.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
So next week is – and by the way, for me, holiday means Christmas. So next week is the Christmas edition of Cooking Issues. Call in all of your, you know, Christmas-related or holiday. Or are we going to do one between Christmas and New Year's?
I don't know because I think New Year's falls on the day of – the next one after Christmas.
Oh, it's on Tuesday?
Mm-hmm.
So next week, your last chance for 2 weeks, right? Is Christmas on a Tuesday?
Yeah.
Something like that?
Yeah.
Oh, shoot, man, I just don't know anything. I can't believe the freaking year is over!
I know.
My God! By the way, we're doing our holiday thing for there's a holiday, what do you call them, like an ice cream social, but without ice cream today, for the Booker and Dax, the equipment company, and Booker and Dax, the bar, are going to meet to ice skate at the Bryant Park. Should be fun, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mustache's like, no, it's not gonna be fun. But you like ice skating.
I do. I just don't like.
Doesn't like getting together with people. Those people. Oh, how
like,
I hate
like
people.
Company softball games and all that. I'm just not.
You've been pestering me about having a company Christmas party.
Yeah,
now
I'm
actually getting
that, like a Christmas party where you drink.
Oh, I'm sure the bartenders are going to show up. They will bring liquor.
I highly doubt it. They'll already be wasted and start skating.
I told Tristan to bring some hot drinks.
I think it's alcohol. It's illegal.
Oh, okay. Well, yes, it's technically illegal. Okay, sorry. We got Mike with his lemongrass. Hello, happy holidays, which is how we got into this nonsense. Happy holidays to everyone at Cooking Issues. I hate mincing lemongrass by hand, and who doesn't? Nastasha hates lemongrass. Guess why? Guess why, people? You can't because you're not here with me. Because it grew in her backyard, and it goes back to her hatred of everything from her childhood.
That's just not true.
Well, why do you hate
it? I used to like play with it and smell it, and like now I feel nauseated when I think about it.
Nastasha, what I love about her is that she properly uses nauseated instead of.
You get very angry.
I do get angry about that one, but what's true or false? You hate like everyone else.
We
is
had
like,
a tangerine tree and a pomegranate tree. I like all those things. The lemongrass, I used to play with it so much.
You know what I used to play with because we didn't have that stuff because I lived in the East Coast here. What? In Jersey? Yeah, you know.
Sewage.
Kind of. Onion grass. I used to rip up onion grass and smell the onion grass constantly, mm-hmm. all the time. Mm-hmm. But I still love myself some onions. Anyway, whatever. Mike hates mincing lemongrass by hand. A few cookbooks recommend against using a food processor, given that the blades create friction and therefore heat, and that this damages the flavor of the lemongrass. Any thoughts on this, given that lemongrass is going to be heated at a later point? Should this even matter to me? Thanks, Mike. I do not think that should matter to you, Mike. I think that's a load of horse hockey. Look, I'm willing to have my butt handed to me on this one, but I don't think it's a problem. I think like the reason I wouldn't use it is that food processor isn't that good at breaking up lemongrass properly, and I detest the long I'm sure Nastasha hates this even more than I do. Is the long fibery craps from an inappropriately processed lemongrass, right?
Yeah.
So I mean, like if you mince it by hand across ways, you're guaranteed to not have any long fibers, which is good. So I mean, I think it's less about the friction or the heat, especially if you're going to heat it later, and because there's not that much heat in a typical food processor. Now you can get a good bit of heat in a VitaPrep or something like that, but I think it's more about the length of the fibers. You don't want any long, nasty fibers. But I detest the texture of kind of cellulosic and lignified fibers in my food. You know, unless I'm chewing on sugar cane, and then I chew on it for some reason because I have a mental problem until my gums bleed. You ever do that?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's terrible, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's horrible.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why instead of using sugarcane in a drink, consider saving the cores from pineapples and vacuum infusing some sugar into the core of a pineapple and using that instead of the typical sugarcane garnish. I need to get our sugarcane press back out to use at the bar. They'll never do it at the bar. But that'd be awesome. Do you like sugarcane drinks?
Mm-hmm.
Like fresh sugarcane
mm-hmm.
juice?
Mm-hmm.
I forget the word for it in Portuguese, but I love that stuff. Yeah, look for it eventually. Eventually, we'll do it someday. Someday. Anyway, so there you go, Mike. And with that, Joe, should we take our first commercial break? Coming right back at you with more cooking issues.
Joe, your computer is so slow, I can't even use this thing.
Yeah, I should probably get a new one. Do you have any suggestions?
Oh, totally, man. You should go to TechServe.
Okay, what's so good about TechServe?
Well, they've got this awesome new insider program that's free when you get a new Mac with AppleCare. So you should buy your computer there because you get 50% off data transfer, free loaner computers, front-of-the-line repair privileges, an annual Mac tune-up service, backup consultation and setup, seminars, and much more.
Okay, yeah, where's TechServe?
It's at 119 West 23rd Street in New York City. They're New York's premier authorized Apple reseller and service provider, and you should totally check out TechServe.com for more information.
All right, that settles it. I'm headed to TechServe.
Man, your computer just got called out. Your computer's busted. Your computer's a flying sack.
Yeah, can you believe that was all improv'd?
And Joe has not made it over to TechServe yet, so his computer still is a steaming pile of poop.
True.
You're allowed to say poop on the air, right?
I think that there's no regulations against poop.
Yeah. I mean, even if we were on the real air, I think I could say poop. Anyway, Matt writes in about lemon juice. Here's a word I'm not going to use on the air. Listen, Matt, I'm going to editorialize a little bit. Come up with a good word, schmutz. How about schmutz? Matt used a much, much worse. In fact, I think one of the worst words in the English language when you think about it. Right?
Dave had to explain this word to me 3 years ago.
Yeah, rhymes with Greg.
And egg.
I'm not going to go into it. Anyway, schmutz. I just got done centrifuging some lemon and lime juice. I started with fresh juice treated with Pectinex. I let it sit for a few hours and make a loose gel with agar. Then I broke the gel up and spun it at 4,000 RPM. Which I'm assuming if you use a similar centrifuge to mine is also roughly 4,000 Gs. The lime turned out perfect, but the lemon had a scum. There you go. Scum's a good one. Floating on the surface, though I was able to remove it with a coffee filter. See below. I had the same thing happen with peach juice a few months back. From what I can see, it appears to be some kind of oil or grease. The question is, what is that scum, and is there a way to avoid it? Thanks, Matt. Well, it depends. There's a couple things that can be floating on the top of the centrifuge. First of all, I would recommend you change your the way that you do lemon and lime juice. You should lemon and lime juice. I would not set with an agar. Nastasha's least fond memories are trying to spin agar gels in the centrifuge. Are these your least fond?
Never want to do it.
What do you hate more?
Ever.
What's the worst? That
when
or
did like grapefruit? How many tons of grapefruit?
I don't know for that. For the oh my god, it was horrible. But no. But what was your least favorite? Is that your least favorite task?
Yeah.
Really?
I think
of
so.
All.
Let me think about it while you're talking.
All right. Okay. So, so anyway, that's not the way to do it. Go buy Kieselsol, which is suspended silica sol from the what's it called? Homebrew shop, and Chitosan, CH Chitosan, also from a homebrew shop. These are wine fining agents, right? Then you add two for every liter of lime juice or lemon juice. Add two milliliters of the SPL, and also 2 milliliters. Be accurate. Of the Kieselsol, stir it, let it sit 15 minutes, add 2 milliliters of Chitosan, stir, also be accurate, 15 minutes, then 2 more milliliters Kieselsol again, stir it up, spin it, you'll be good every time. That's just that's the way to do lemon juice or lime juice. That's what we do at the bar, and it never fails. Okay, now to your other problem, stuff floating on top. There are two things that can be going on. Sometimes you spin something that has some fat in it, in which case it floats up to the top. Sometimes you have some fat contaminating your buckets, if you spin directly in the buckets, as I do, in which case it floats on top. More often than not, what's floating on the top looks like fat but isn't, is a floated layer of stuff, and it could be broken up cell stuff, which is phospholipids, but I doubt it. It could be some fat. Anyway, air. So what happens is when you blend something or when you stir it or whisk it, you get air bubbles. And believe it or not, even under the force of 4,000 times the force of gravity, air bubbles don't necessarily pop. And so you have a layer of stuff floating at the top of a lot of things after they spin, even if they don't have fat in them. And the way to get around that is to do a quick vacuum cycle to de-aerate the product before you spin it. And if you do that, pretty much you'll get crystal clear stuff on the top from the get-go. Certain things are more apt to throw a thing on the top than others. Tomatoes typically will have a layer floating on the top. If you vacuum them, they won't. Certain things you can't get around it, like coconuts have a lot of fat in them, and so if you blend those and don't get the air out, you get a thick mat floating on the top, which actually tastes good. But anyway, so that is my theory, and that's what's going on. That's how to avoid it. Remember that? What were we spinning that time that was crazy? Oh, no. Also, when you're going to put stuff in a rotovap, if you don't want it to boil over after you blend it, you put it in a vacuum machine, chamber vacuum machine, you de-aerate it. That's just, you know, standard procedure, but a lot of people don't do it. And then when they run the rotovap for the first time, it sprays all over the inside of the machine. Do you remember that time we had to de-aerate all of that? Was it the habanero that almost killed us when we de-aerated, or was it the horseradish?
I think it was the horseradish.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that sucked.
Lots of horrible times.
Every day with Dave is a horrible day. Right?
No.
Just most.
Back then, when we did everything ourselves.
We were in the school, and we were working out of a trash room. I mean,
it's like 100 by 100 square foot.
And it was like a billion degrees. Now, people, Nastasia hates me for a number of reasons, but one that she detests more than any other is the fact that I am an insensate brute, and yes, that my body doesn't care what kind of temperature it's put in. Whether you could freeze me out, you could burn me, you could light my hands on fire. It just doesn't seem to bother me that much. And for some reason, this is in Nastasha's playbook the hallmark of a poor person, a low quality individual, as we like to say. I can't help it; things don't bother me. But that trash room averaged like 115 degrees because we were in the same room as the refrigeration units. I'm talking like all year, 115 degrees in that son of a gun. And here's the thing about me, like I don't mind any temperature if I'm working, but if I'm sitting in a trash room sweating into a keyboard, I want to kill everybody. Everybody, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I could be outside in that weather working if I was doing something. Or cooking in a million degree, I don't care. You know what I mean? Like, you know.
Those were legitimate temperature readings, like 115. Remember that?
Oh, yeah. No, remember when we got those new thermometers? We were like, come on. And then we calibrated them and we're like, no, it's really like, it's 115 degrees in here. And let me tell you something. It wasn't like 115 Arizona style, which is still piss hot. Because I've been to Arizona where they're like, hey, you know, 100 degrees is legitimately not that hot in Arizona. It really isn't. You can go outside in 100 degree weather and it's fine. You know what I mean? Because it's so freaking dry. Because it's not the heat, it's the humidity. But listen, at 115 degrees, people, it is hot. Now, in New York, it's 115 sweet, humid degrees inside of that trash box. Man, that sucked. Remember that?
Yes.
We're sitting there spinning agar gels and oh my God. Anyway, good times. And that was back, remember when, but my favorite part about it was, I remember there was someone who wrote an internet article back when we were still doing the blog. We're going to get that fixed again, right?
Jerry, the Christmas break, yeah.
Yeah, Christmas break. We're going to get that fixed again. Back when we were going full bore on the blog, which we hope to again someday. I'm going to get Piper to write for it, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, anyway. When we were doing that, I had a guy say, well, I don't have all of like the awesome resources that Dave has. And Nastasha and I read this, and we burst out laughing, right? We were laughing for like 20 minutes straight in a 115 degree hot box with stuff. Everything is taped together with duct tape. Listen, I'm happy with everything. I'm totally happy. So this is not like, oh, poor little Rick. You know what I mean? But like the fact of the matter is that everything we own is held together with duct tape. Right? Yes.
The phone was duct taped to the wall.
The phone was duct taped to the wall. That's my goal. My New Year's resolution, people, is to not be the guy whose box is duct taped together when he shows up to the party. You get a new box! Chip writes in about Calusians. Nastasha, Dave, Jack, and Joe. Well, crap on Jack because he doesn't like us anymore. He's not showing up to the show. Just kidding. I love Jack. Everyone loves Jack, right?
Mm-hmm.
Even though he insulted Joe's computer and I take umbrage.
Yes.
Have you been to Calusians recently? Calusians, by the way, for those of you that haven't been in New York, Calusians is kind of a well-known and amazing kind of spice and ingredient shop. I guess it started out as having a lot of Indian and that kind of subcontinent style ingredients, but now has just ingredients from everywhere all over the world. And chefs regularly make pilgrimages to Calusians to kind of just browse the aisles and see kind of what exists or what's something they haven't used before, and you can buy them in fairly small packages. A similar store for those of you, it's in the 20s on Lexington Avenue here in Manhattan. There's another store called Dual Specialty Shop, which is a dumb name for, no offense if anyone, no one's ever listening. But the Dual Specialty Shop is a really dumb name. It's over on First Avenue, I think, over downtown in the East Village. And they have, they're not as big, but they have a lot of interesting ingredients as well. So people go there searching for ingredients for bitters, for cooking, whatnot. Anyway, so that's what Calusians is, and you know, great place. I went in for some spices and noticed they have a large selection of modern ingredients. They are not listed in the website, so you have to actually go there to verify. Sorry. By the way, Calusians website, one of the world's worst websites. It's a horrible website. Horrible. No offense. Crap. It's crap. Horrible. It's impossible to search for things on their website. Anyway. Anyway, just a few that I remember them having are Kappa and Iota Carrageenan, Ultra Crisp from National Starch Corporation. National Starch. I wish anyone would have a name as good as National Starch. National Starch. And maltodextrin. Now, but the question is what kind? See, one of the problems with Calusians is when they're bagging stuff like that, they don't necessarily write the provenance of the material on it. So you don't know exactly what it is. That's one of the issues. Anyway, But there are probably two shelving units full of these ingredients. So it is nice if you're in a pinch. Most were in the 1 ounce or 2 ounce bags. So good tip. I did know that, but I haven't mentioned it on air as a place you can walk in and get stuff. So it's good. I don't think Dual Specialty has those kind of ingredients. So you're going to go to Clusians for that kind of thing. I also wanted to send you a picture of the turkey I did this year. I saw it. You can't see it because you're listening on the radio, but it's a nice looking turkey.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Looked good to me. Anyway, in the smoker for about 2.5 hours, wet. I like to mispronounce herb and call it herb.
How does McGee say it?
McGee?
Yeah. I think he says herb.
You think?
Mm-hmm.
Like Herb the guy?
Mm-hmm.
Whenever I say herb, I think herb like Herbie. By the way, Nastasha and I sit. This is what we actually do for a living. We don't work on anything. We sit around and watch the YouTube of Hermie the elf getting his butt handed to him by the lead elf over and over. Both the original version and the Full Metal Jacket version. Both of them. It's an all-time. Look, Rankin Bass, it's crazy with all the weird, like, pagan weirdness that goes on. But you got to love those shows.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, back to this. In a smoker for about 2.5 hours, a wet herb rub under the skin. There were only four of us, so it went with a traditional cooking method as well. Thanks for the great podcast. Chip, thank you, and thank you for your picture of your turkey, right?
Mm-hmm.
Turkeys. Okay, we have some questions in from the Twitter. Ellie Nasser writes in, 3-bone prime rib for Christmas, cooked off sous vide. And the question is, off the bone? Okay, wait. Off the bone? 55C? Finish in a 550 oven for about 15-20 minutes? Those are all questions. So here's the answer. That's actually like a compact Twitter question. Good. Compact Twitter question. Here's the thing. If you're going to do it, typically if you're going to actually cook one, what you'll do is you'll cut it off the bone, sear around, and then this is what some people do, then retie it back to the bone and cook it using the bone as kind of an insulator, protectant. You don't need to do that if you're going to do it sous vide. I don't. Whether or not you pull the bone off is up to you, right? But typically, okay. Now here's where I'm going to go against everything I've ever said. Just for easiness' sake, I would bag the sucker and cook it to 55C. 55 is a good number. 55C, 55.1, 55.2. Do nothing to it beforehand. Then this is where I'm going to sound crazy. Just like bag it in a zippy with some oil, cook it off to 55. Let it cool down. For quite a while, actually, and then throw it into your super hot oven for longer than 15 to 20 minutes. I would do it until you get a nice, nice, super crisp crust. You like prime rib, right, Stas?
Yeah.
Stas, what's your favorite part about prime rib?
It smells like home.
Oh, okay. Well, weird. I was going to say the crunchy outside parts that are overcooked along with the inside that's rare. So you don't want to skimp on producing those crunchy burnt fat things on the outside. So I would say do a 55, let it cool down for a minute, and then a little bit longer in the oven at the super high temperature. When I did my turkey this year, I had it in there for like an hour and a half in a pretty hot oven because I had cooked it all the way through. So I wouldn't be afraid of overcooking the outside in a traditional way because we love it, that stuff. The worst prime rib I ever did was when I cooked it sous vide all the way through and didn't finish enough on the outside, and it was too uniform in the middle. It was a horrible nightmare. You say we had a call?
Yes.
Caller, you're on the air.
Hi, my name's Peter Bellestray. I live in Wisconsin, Milwaukee. I help run my family restaurant, and I just graduated from CIA about a year ago, and I'm looking to go back to school for food science and wondering if you could make me like top 5 schools or just general advice on that.
So like when you say food science, do you mean actual food science like a PhD, or do you mean just kind of new techniques for use in restaurant?
I think a combination of both.
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. Most of the actual food science places are focused on more industrial applications. And it's changing a little bit now, but the issue is that there's very little money in worrying about problems that are only geared towards restaurants. In other words, to fund real scientific research. That's changing a little bit. I would look at the kind of Research Chefs Association if you're interested in food science programs. I mean, I don't know who's currently the best. I mean, especially out where you are, I don't know what's currently the best. I mean, over here – I mean, obviously, Rutgers has a good program in food science because it's near where a lot of the flavor houses are. There's also Cornell has an interesting food science program. You might want to look at, but I don't really know who's the best feeder for that kind of stuff. I mean, obviously, if you want to do wine or enology, Davis, you know, I don't know kind of what the kind of programs that they have. The other thing is that you know, if you do some work in that, like maybe get a master's, that's you could then get a job being a chef or doing research work at a flavor house. We just met, you know, a bunch of them, and they're kind of an interesting crew. Now, from a food tech for restaurant stuff, I mean, obviously, you know, we teach at the FCI, we teach low temperature sous vide work that's geared at chefs. That's like 2 days in and out. It's not a food science class by any stretch. It's like a low temperature sous vide. Chris Young is from Modernist Cuisine is starting up his program at Johnson Wales. But you know, Chris Loss, who's at CIA, is still doing some work with that too. But I don't know what kind of classes they offer. But it's all a question of what you're trying to do with it. Do you know what I mean? I don't know how much a food science program is going to help in a restaurant unless you're just a lover of knowledge. In which case, go for it. You know what I mean? I mean that's what gets me up in the morning is just liking knowledge. So.
Yeah, I mean, and that's kind of one of the reasons I want to go back. Is like I want to continue learning. You know, and with everything I learned from school. Now being able to apply it to my family restaurant, I kind of want to continue that. I'm only 23, and I feel like I wouldn't really, like, going to school here isn't set in my mind. I still want to travel and, like, see things and learn things, so that's part of it as well.
Right. I mean, if you get, you know, another thing you can do, if you're interested in just, like, the restaurant side of it, you know, and this is what a lot of people I know do. They go, they work for someone in the U.S. that they can get, you know, stage, basically, for someone who is doing this kind of work, right?
Right.
And then, you know, so, you know, Wiley or, you know, Grant or, you know, Paul Lee Brandt, someone, you know what I mean? And then after a while of staging there, they then get the recommendations to go work at, like Noma or in Spain, and then you know they make the you know they'll spend some while. So that's you know Fabulous, who's you know works with us for a long time. That's what he you know he worked with us for a while, then worked with Johnny Azzini back when he was at Jean Georges for a long time, and then you know spent a long time staging at Noma and other places and traveled the world and has picked up. You know, if you're young and if you can you know if you can do it, if you can live that lifestyle, is a good way to see what is current right now in kitchen, but you have to be willing to put your time in each one of the kitchens for that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely.
But it sounds like you're...
And I mean, I guess that's kind of a fact I've been... I mean, I knew already, but I think I've been kind of faking to myself that it isn't. But thank you. This was very helpful.
And by the way, that last... The trepidation you're showing is very smart. Like, if you even think that you don't want to do that, then don't send yourself down that road. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because if you send yourself down that road and you start feeling like, you know, this wasn't the right move, it's a long road to be halfway down and find out that it wasn't the road you wanted to be on. Do you know what I'm saying?
Right.
Whereas, you know, if you're going to go take a program in a school like food science, you're learning all the time and it's not the same sort. I don't think you'll feel the same sort of sense of crap if it's not the road you want to go down. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah.
And I guess that's what I still need to decide.
Right. Cool. Well, good luck, and I hope everything works out for you.
All right. Thank you very much.
No problem. Okay. So at Clef's, I don't know at Clef's name because at Clef's name is written in Japanese characters that I don't understand on his or her. I don't know, Twitter feed. But, you know, one of our Twitter buddies. Can melatonin be used as an antioxidant in food? Does it have any advantages? So melatonin is, you know, a hormone that I guess is made in the pineal gland. And, it regulates sleep patterns and a bunch of other things. It's a powerful, also, antioxidant. And it's sold as a dietary supplement here in the U.S., but it's not – there's a strange rule in the U.S., and here it is. It's that if I – like the rules for selling you something that you put into your body as a dietary supplement are a lot less stringent than the rules governing what you put into food. And it, like, everything is completely back buttward on this kind of stuff. For instance, also, like, it's like the same thing where well, not the same, but the irritating the way regulations work. You know, eugenol and isoeugenol, which is clove oil, is considered safe to eat, but is not approved to use as a fish anesthetic. That's the dumbest thing in the world. So when we use it, we have to say that it's a spice. Dumb. Anyway, but the other side, and actually can be crazy, is that things that aren't on the GRAS, i.e. generally regarded as safe, which is the main list of things, can be used as dietary supplements. So you can buy melatonin as a dietary supplement, and you could grind it up and add it to a beverage, but there was an energy drink manufacturer who was making a relaxation, blah, 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 that added – doped it with melatonin, not just things that contained melatonin, but doped it with melatonin. And they got a warning letter saying that, you know, you shouldn't do that. It was – the company was Innovative Beverage, and they had these relaxation drinks that had melatonin, and it's not approved as a food additive. That said, I mean, I don't see why technically it wouldn't work. I don't know what the stuff tastes like. Have you ever taken them?
No.
I mean, no, I've never taken it. I mean, the other thing is, you know, one thing to do, and I don't have time to – I didn't have time to do it before now, but, like, you could just buy some melatonin, grind it up, and add it to some stuff that usually turns nasty, like apple juice, and see whether or not it keeps the apple juice from, you know, turning. But be aware that even though melatonin is passed fairly quickly in the, by the liver, according to what I read, it's like a one pass through the liver and it's out. You might make people sleepy time, right? Because it's supposed to be the relaxation thing. So if you want people, you know, passing out at your restaurant table, you know, anyway. So that's my thing. But I do not know, and I cannot what's the word? Advocate. Okay. So a couple things that I'm working on now. I sent out a Twitter question. Where can we get pig bladders? Because Piper saw Chef at Danielle use pig bladder. Pig bladder, and this – I started thinking about it again because we got a question, I don't know, about a month ago or a couple weeks ago about not using plastic bags for sous vide work. And so I was interested because there's an old kind of natural en papillot technique where you use a pig bladder to hold things in while you cook them. And so I was wondering whether or not you could use a pig bladder to do some kind of rudimentary low temp work. Now, the problem obviously is that pig bladders, unlike plastic bags, are semi-permeable, i.e. things can travel in and out of it. In fact, the whole notion of a semi-permeable membrane was discovered with pig bladders by a guy named, Jean-Antoine Noyer, who's a physicist in the 1700s. And, he was the person who noticed that pig bladders slowly pass things in and out. And there was other experiments afterwards that showed that certain things can migrate across pig bladders. So the question is, if you were going to cook for short periods of time, I think you could probably cook in a pig bladder without too much flavor crossing back and forth, or too much loss, or too much kind of the fact that it's poaching. Because the numbers that I read were that the transfer rate across pig bladder membranes is fairly slow. You could also probably coat the pig bladder in something that would reduce the permeability even more, like Zane or something like that. But then it wouldn't, you know, then that's kind of a pain in the butt. But I found a couple sources for pig bladders on the internets, thanks to the folks on Twitter. We have two different sources of it that sent in. So we're going to get ourselves some pig bladders, probably not before New Year, and we're going to do some low-temperature pig bladder work. How's that sound?
Sounds good.
Sounds good. And lastly, I'll leave with this. I'm going to do some more lobster experiments. So for those of you that follow my lobster, and Stas is like, oh, crap, more lobster. But the last time I did lobster experiments, Stas, I did it at my house. You didn't have to deal with it.
Yeah, no, I'm not.
Do you even like lobster?
Yeah, it's okay.
What's your favorite crustacean?
I don't know. Keep talking.
You don't like crab, right?
No.
God damn it. Didn't mean to curse. Crab is delicious.
Oh. Ooh, oysters.
Oysters. That's not a crustacean.
Oh.
That's a mollusk. Oh. You like oysters more than clams?
Squid.
Squid, also a mollusk.
Then none.
Okay, no shrimp. No crab.
No.
Lobster.
No. If I have to, a lobster roll.
Oh, Jesus. Okay, keep you guys posted.
Soft shell crab. It's good.
Soft shell crab is delicious. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I've mentioned this on soft shell crab, but I love me some soft shell crab. Do you ever prepare them?
No.
Do you know my favorite fact? I've told you this a million times. My favorite fact about soft shell crabs? Because when you cut their eyes off, you have to cut their eyes off, along with their brain. They bred themselves. So you cut their eyes off, you pull up the little tab in the back, you rip the gills out, you put it down, you throw it in the breading, and they bred themselves. That is consideration. That is a considerate food stuff. Yeah? Anyway, yeah. We'll fill you in on my lobster test next time. Cooking issues!
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.